Back at it for you on Monday, April 6th, another week of coronavirus coverage right here on Connecticut Today. Our first guest is connected with the World Health Organization and at one time was also working for the National Security Council. He talked about his attitudes toward the coronavirus, a new book, what the U.S. is doing wrong, what it's doing right, and the long-term implications of this. And then in the 3 o'clock hour, we, of course, carried the daily coronavirus briefing from Governor Ned Lamont. Our great guests, the first of which we have on the line right now. He's a WHO expert, World Health Organization expert, former National Security Council official, and the author of a new book, Hacking Darwin, Genetic Engineering and the Future of Humanity. Once again, Hacking Darwin, Genetic Engineering and the Future of Humanity. He's got some observations as we look at this whole coronavirus pandemic, which may peak around here. This week, we welcome Jamie Metzl to the program. Jamie, hi. It's Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you?
I'm great, Paul. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Well, we know you're a former person, a person connected to the World Health Organization. Give me your overall two-three paragraph capsule look at what you've been observing the past couple of months here.
So this whole thing is a tragedy that's unfolding in many, many chapters, but there is always hope. And so the first chapter was when this began in China. There was a total failure among the Chinese authorities to respond. Then the world hadn't created the kind of empowered resource World Health Organization that could have stopped this in its tracks. And then there was a fundamental, monumental screw up by the U.S. federal government. And so almost more than 2 months where we should have been having emergency preparations, not only was very, very little done, but the wrong things were done. We said we had bad tests. We had the president of the United States underplaying this crisis that had already begun. And because of that, we have just this terrible suffering and death, and unnecessarily certainly here in the United States. So the number, I'm in New York City, the numbers are growing very, very rapidly. But social distancing and a lot of the emergency responses are starting to work. And I know that President Trump had said everything's going to be normal by April. But in a very significant way, our lives are never going to fully go back to what they were before. And we aren't going to be living anything that even feels like normal life until there's a vaccine, and not only a vaccine, but a vaccine that can be distributed, manufactured at scale and distributed around the world. And if we could do that in 18 months, it would be a great miracle. And that doesn't mean that we're not going to have better and worse. I think in the next few months, we may be able to ease things a little bit. People may be able to go out more, but you know, nobody's going to a full stadium football game maybe for 2 years.
Wow. Wow, that's interesting. So you're saying definitely not this season and maybe next season as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a huge disruption of our lives. We're going to do better. We're going to develop treatments. We're going to develop strategies. But it's really hard. The United States is a big, complicated country. And we've had a total breakdown in our civic culture. When you look at a country like Greece and you compare it to Norway, both countries have really great constitutions. Issue, but Norway is really well organized. They have a strong civic culture. We're paying the price of decades of people have this whole thing, government isn't the solution. The government is the problem. We've had a war on our government. Now we're really paying the price because the United States federal government, the executive branch, has fundamentally failed the American people. And it's one of the worst mess ups in all of American history. And people are dying as a result. And it's a tragedy. But people are also coming together in incredible ways. And if our federal government can't do it, people are stepping up, and that really gives me hope. And that's why platforms like yours are so essential, because if people are feeling despair, we're right to feel this way. We're right to mourn. But nobody should be just watching Netflix all day. Everybody's got a role. This is a fight that we're all in for our future.
Jamie, and the guest is Jamie Metzl. Jamie, what about the early response or people are saying lack thereof from the Chinese government? I've had a couple of epidemiologists on the program here, infectious disease folks, who say by the numbers we were getting out of Beijing and the Chinese authorities, they really, for a good few weeks, were not concerned about this.
Well, I'll just tell you how I was thinking of things when this news started coming out in January. I know China very well. In the old days when I used to travel, I was in China all the time. And so I knew that if there was an infectious disease outbreak, China was going to take that very seriously. And when they, because they had experienced SARS and other of these outbreaks. And so when they set up their emergency hospital in Wuhan, I knew they were going to do it in the smartest way they knew how, which is was going to be a smart way. And when their doctors and their nurses in very large numbers got it, I knew that we were dealing with something that was very different. And it wasn't just me. It was the U.S. intelligence service also came to that conclusion and delivered reports to President Trump saying that. And that was just at the time when the president was saying, everything's fine. It's not coming here. And then we totally screwed up the testing. And so when we shut the borders, the disease was already here. And it was like locking the door after the burglars are already in the house.
Was the travel ban a bad idea when he did it?
It wasn't a terrible idea. And everybody lots of other countries have done it. But if we don't have testing, like we had no way of knowing where the problem was or whether people here were more infected already than the people who were coming because we had no tests, even though other countries like Korea then, who had the same level of warning, they did have the tests. So if you have no information, you can make all kinds of decisions, but it's hard to make really smart decisions.
Jamie Metzl's here of the World Health Organization, also the new book, Hacking Darwin, Genetic Engineering and the Future of Humanity. It's 141 right here on WICC 600 with Connecticut Today. Jamie, you know, this kind of thing has been warned about, not for a year, not for 2 years, but I can remember hearing interviews and reading books and treatises on this 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago. And Congress usually does the thing they usually do. They bring in two or three witnesses, and members of both parties sit there enraptured going, oh, that would be really bad, yeah. And for decades, we basically done nothing, have we? I mean, has anything been done in Washington of any great import that could have stopped this?
Yeah, that's the heartbreak. So in the 90s, I was on the National Security Council, and the person who I worked for then and now a very close friend is a guy named Richard Clark. You may know that name because he was the one who predicted 9/11 mm-hmm. and was trying to get the government to do something and wasn't able to convince anybody or not enough people. And so in those days, there was a whole emergency preparedness plan, not just for this, but for all kinds of these high-level threats, and there were exercises, there were national stockpiles. We even forward deployed U.S. public health officials into China, and we set up an Office of Pandemic Response in the White House. The Trump administration, and not just the Trump administration, but cut funding for these kinds of programs. They ended the White House office that had responsibility for this, and that's the tragedy. I mean, it's if you have a fire department and you underfund the fire department, if you denigrate the fire department, if you insult the firefighters publicly, and you do all of these things, it doesn't matter until there's a fire. But once there's a fire, it really matters. And government, when it works, is kind of an insurance policy that we have a bunch of people who are doing stuff that we don't necessarily need now, but we're paying our taxes so that they can do their jobs. And all of this madness that we've had in this country, that we have to have a war on government and starve the beast and all of that kind of stuff. Yes, there's waste in government. Yes, there's inefficiency. Yes, it could be better. But now we're suffering and dying as a result of that mentality. And the societies that are better organized than we are, like Korea, which is also a democracy, are doing better.
Jamie Metzl is the guest, former member of the National Security Council, currently associated with the World Health Organization. And, Jamie, one thing I want to ask you from your past experience, I have a theory that, and I could be completely wrong with this, do you think that the medical folks looking at this early on would have said wear face masks or face protection had all of that stuff been stockpiled and or ready? Or was this, let's keep it quiet, we don't want people to go crazy, we don't have the supplies to begin with, we don't have 300 million face masks times the 5 or 10 of them you'd need. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't think that's the case. For any of you, of your listeners who travel in Asia, when you go to places like Japan, like Korea, like China, you realize there are just tons of people who are wearing face masks. And the reason why, primarily in those cultures, is not because they're afraid of getting sick from you. It's that there's a cultural thing that when you are feeling a little bit sick, you wear a face mask to protect other people. So
really?
we already don't start with that culture. But then there's something more. For the people in Asia, they had the experience of SARS, of all these terrible infectious diseases that had primarily hit there. And so when this happened, their framework was SARS. In the United States, my brother is a physician here in New York, and I was telling him early this year, like, this is really serious. I'm telling you, this is serious. And he was talking to other physicians in the hospital, and they said, oh, no, this is ridiculous. This is just like the flu. This is all overblown. And I kept saying, no, it's not like the flu.
So wait a minute. Wait. You're arguing with the guy who has a medical degree. I know you love your brother. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But
no,
you must have been there.
You must have been there going,
what universe is this?
No, I was, unfortunately, I don't know how this happened, but I give medical advice to everybody in my life, including doctors who call me. I don't know why that is. But it's probably confidence like yours, Paul. But anyway, and so I think that's what happened, is that in Asia, the frame was SARS, and that was serious. Here, the frame was flu, which is, it's an annoyance, it's even deadly, but we haven't mobilized our entire society or shut down the economy to fight the flu. And I think that was the core problem, is that our whole mental frame was just wrong.
Yeah, and it's funny you mention that, Jamie, because one of the infectious disease people I've spoken to over the past few weeks, highly qualified person, I asked a similar question. I said, what did you and your cohorts in the field think? And this person said, well, we thought from the info that we could get out of China originally that SARS was back in a somewhat weakened form, maybe a mutated form, and we'll be okay. We'll get our arms around this.
Yep. That's exactly right.
Yeah. So your outlook, Jamie Metzl, you mentioned no football for 2 years. Oh, you know what that's going to do to me. But anyway, save some knees and some orthopedic work for these guys. But really, where will we be 6 months from now? Let's project into the fall. Give me what is happening in the few minutes we have left. What's happening and what's not happening?
So here's my best guess. In fall, we'll have better treatments. We'll be able to identify who has antibodies through earlier exposures and who may be a little more able to to go out in public a little bit more. So we'll have much more testing, universal testing. If we're extremely successful, we'll be able to open up society a little more. So maybe Our kids will go to school on alternate days because we won't be able to have that kind of crowding. So maybe there'll be Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday kids and Monday, Wednesday, Friday kids. But we're not going to have anything that looks at all like the lives that we had before this until there's a vaccine. And even then, the lives that we had aren't just going to snap back. This is not like a snow day where you just wait it out. And that's why it's really important that everybody who's home start living your life in this reality. And that means strengthening and investing in your communities, training yourself, learning new things, thinking about how your business and your life are going to change, and prepare for that. Because if you're just home binge watching Netflix, you're not going to be ready for the world that's coming. You're going to wander around the rest of your life reminding people that coffee used to cost a nickel.
What about if you binge watch Netflix and eat Haagen-Dazs too to excess? will that help? You know, will that help?
You know that we'll put an asterisk on that, and you should also do things that make you happy. And if that's your thing, do that once in a while.
The name of the book is Hacking Darwin: Genetic Engineering and the Future of Humanity. The guest, Jamie Metzl, a member of the World Health Organization and also a former member of the National Security Council. All right, Jamie, hopefully we can hook up a few months down the line and see how good your predictions have been. We thank you for the time. Thanks for stopping by. Stay safe in New York City. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Paul.
I'm here with Paul Mounds and Roland Cook. I'll introduce in a minute. Just give you our briefing, first of all, in terms of where we are in the numbers. Another 1,200 people tested positive out of 3,400 tests. I think what makes that interesting or not is that really is a reflection on the number of tests we've had. 36% testing positive is slightly higher, but that's a number that goes up and down, and we'll talk about why that may not be the best indicator of what's going on. I think of real interest to me as I look at hospitalization. You see 79 people hospitalized. That's a number, again, that's going up not exponentially, but going up on a linear basis, which is, I think, good news. 17 fatalities is never good news, but again, it's a number that's not going up exponentially. And what that means is it gives us capacity to plan. And this is following what our modeling has been. And I start with our healthcare system. Our healthcare system is bending, but it's not breaking. And that's because we did built in capacity in terms of everything we're trying to do. And that capacity, as I've described in terms of other in other briefings, in terms of beds, in terms of people, in terms of ICU, we're planning accordingly for what we've got to do. And this linear allows us to plan even more. I'll tell you that the capacity is important in terms of a lot of our other functions that we're performing, you know, as a state as well. We talked about nursing homes over the last couple days. Obviously, the infection rate in the nursing homes is high and continues to grow. The good news is there we have several nursing homes, 1,000 beds. We're getting them online. We're going to have COVID-only nursing homes. And that means we're going to have COVID-free nursing homes, and that gives us a lot more confidence that we'll be able to contain the virus in a Kirkland, Washington-type situation is a little less likely to occur. Obviously, other group settings include the homeless. And again, there are folks living in close quarters where we got to be able to quarantine out those who have tested or contact somebody who is COVID positive and get them quarantined. And we've created about, I think it's 1,500 beds spread across 14 hotels, mainly double rooms. Again, so we can get the homeless taken care of in a safe and quarantined area and are much less likely to be able to disperse walking around a community. Roland Cook is our great commissioner on corrections. There's been a lot of talk about corrections, and I'll ask him to speak in a few minutes. But what's important to know there is, like with nursing homes and like with the homeless, over the last 3, 4, 5 years, we have extra capacity in our nursing homes. Over the last couple of months, over 700 people have been released. Low violent, lowest risk folks who were incarcerated are there for very minor probation-related issues. And on the other side of the equation, Roland is also looking at the oldest of our folks who are incarcerated, those who might be most likely to be at risk to a COVID infection. And again, seeing where they can be treated most safely. Is there a safe place outside of the correction facility where they can be taken care of? Or perhaps one of our negative pressure zones in the correction facility itself, which is quarantine, is the safest place. That's what our real priorities are. Moving to this next page, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, the demand curve and what you see in terms of the increase in folks who are infected in our state. And it's a little tough to see, but this was in the president's briefing over the last couple of days, and I had dozens of people say, I can't read it. Can you describe what's going on, especially as it impacts Connecticut? I think one thing you should know is that when New York City sneezes, Connecticut catches cold. And that's what happened in terms of the spread of the virus from New Rochelle. We talked about it, the pandemic in and around greater New York City. And you'll see going up further on. So I'll break this down county by county. But this chart gives you some very interesting things. You'll see the rate of increase in New York City. New York State is a misnomer. It's really New York City going up, followed by New Jersey, followed by Louisiana. I think I mentioned they have a real pandemic in their New Orleans area, followed by Massachusetts is going up. Connecticut, our rate of increase is not going up quite as quickly, and there may be a variety of reasons for that, one of which is social distancing, another which may be we may be just a little less dense than downtown New Orleans and New York City. And that advantages our efforts at social distancing. The rest of the chart, you can see other states, all the way down to Vermont and Colorado and Illinois. But I think that gives you a little bit of sense that our social distancing may be having a positive impact. Next slide, please. Just for those of you like me who maybe had a hard time reading the Enauer print, we've broken this down a little bit more. Just in terms of five states that are most impacted. And obviously, again, you can see New York and New Jersey. You can see Connecticut versus Washington State. That's interesting, where Washington State got into this, let's say, a couple weeks sooner than Connecticut. And it could be that they are flattening out. It could be they have really exceptional social distancing. It could be they got people into critical care faster. But there, they've flattened out that curve in a way that Connecticut is attempting to flatten out that curve it's too early to say with success, but making progress. California, you see in the bottom there, they were early on. And they were early on in terms of social distancing, as was Connecticut. And so you can see they really have flattened out that curve in a meaningful way. So I think we have some information that indicates to the degree to which you think testing in infections is a good barometer, which I can counter in a second. We are beginning to make some progress thanks to our social distancing effort. And because we're able to slowly flatten that curve, not going up quite as fast, again, it gives our hospitals, and not to mention corrections and nursing, a little more room to plan accordingly. This is important because we're on with Dr. Ambassador Birx today, who you've seen on the White House briefings, and we said it's misleading to talk about this pandemic in terms of states. Obviously, Southern Connecticut, you're 10 times more likely to be infected than you are in, New London County. So you have to think about this in terms of regions, and to try to reinforce our case, we've got this issue here for you to look at, positive cases by county. Again, you can see Fairfield is leading the pack. You can see New Haven is accelerating as well. Hartford a little bit flatter. New London, Tallinn, Litchfield, obviously a lot slower, in part because they're further from what was the heart of this in greater New York area. And we've had a little more time to plan and prepare there. Again, at one point, we thought that Fairfield and New Haven would be like a hockey stick. And right now, that's more linear. It's going up. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. But because it's going up on a linear basis, that gives us a little more time to plan. This is a chart I want to spend a minute on because it's much more reflective of what's going on, and that's hospitalizations. A lot of people take a look at the infections, and you'll see they've bounced around a little bit, going up, going down. What does that mean? That often is a reflection of simply testing. Well, hospitalizations, whether we've tested only 5% of the folks or 20% of the people in, say, New Haven County, hospitalizations is a better indicator of what's going on in that greater community, what's going on in terms of a community infection. Hospitalizations and sadly fatalities are graphs that I think are maybe, a week to 2 weeks behind infections, but perhaps a better indicator of what's going on and a better indicator for us when it comes to modeling. And I think you can see here, it's a little confusing, the day-by-day change. But you'll see the day-by-day change is not going up day-by-day. The daily count line, that orange line, is going up, again, on a linear basis. I take this as reasonable good news, reasonable that situation could have been a lot more severe. We might not have been flattening out the curve or at least making it more linear. And this gives us a lot more room to breathe. The next chart is sort of a reflection of what you had before. Again, in Fairfield County, you can see we had 41 additional hospitalizations. New Haven behind it, but only 12 more hospitalizations. So while their infection rate went up a lot, in part reflective of testing, their hospitalizations are going up modestly, again, which gives us time to plan. No new hospitalizations in New London. Is that one less in Wyndham? I mean, this is one of the things we are going to be working on for you over the next couple of days. I'm telling you all the new hospitalizations, but we're also going to show you discharges so you can see what the net increase or decrease is. You see in New York City over the last, 4 or 5 days, the rate of the net increase in hospitalizations actually went down. They're building a little bit more capacity. And I think you're going to see a similar trend here. Again, which gives us hope that when it comes to ventilators, when it comes to PPE, when it comes to ICU beds, when it comes to hospital beds, we are building ourselves some room. And that is what we always tried to do when we talked about flattening the curve. Again, the Dr. Burke's analysis, when you saw everything going on with infections, can be a little bit misleading. There's the denominator and there's the numerator. And I think it may mean in terms of our modeling that some of our worst case scenarios, the 20% of the people, tested end up, going to the hospital, at least found to be carrying a virus. Well, in fact, our hospitalization rates may be a lot lower than that because the number of people hospitalized is not based upon just the number of people we've tested, but it's based upon everybody that's infected out there. So, Josh and our DPH team are working carefully as we relook at these models all the time to see how fast we get to that apex, how fast we can flatten that curve, and what the gradual downslope on this will be. We were just on with the Vice President's task force, and he gave us some sobering reminders that when we talk about the next day, it may not be the next day, it may be the next year. And it may mean that there are a series of rolling pandemics over a period of time. So we're thinking very carefully about, as we maybe get to the backside of the increase in our infections, the increase in our hospitalizations over the next couple of months, how can we thoughtfully get people back to work without having another wave of infections? And that a lot of that's going to be in and around more broad-based testing. You'll probably see from the first graph that while a lot of folks are saying our testing is down, we had 3,400 tests I showed you, came in yesterday. And I've told you about Semaphore, I've told you about Abbott Labs. Our testing is going to be going up dramatically. What testing allows us to do is to see a red, yellow, green, what it looks like in terms of infection and intensity in given areas, and where we might be able to get people back to work sooner. I am working with a number of folks, including our friend Ryan Drazwitz, in terms of antibody testing. And antibody testing, I'd like to think we'll be able to roll out in the not-too-distant future. What does antibody testing mean? That's a blood test. And that will tell us who was built up in immunity to the COVID virus, who maybe was infected, didn't know they were infected, who was of an age group and they have the immunity. They're the ones we can get back to work. They're the ones who are going to keep our manufacturing going. They're the ones we get back in terms of construction. They're the ones that we can get back into our workforce sooner. This is something we're going to do on a very thoughtful basis to make sure we don't have a second wave, as happened in the Spanish flu and other situations. And this is something I talked about with Dr. Fauci just a few days ago. We're trying to get insight from the federal government as well in terms of what we can do in terms of antibody testing and how we can accelerate so we know what people can do when. And before, you know, introducing Roland, I will say I'm cutting off here to go talk to Secretary Esper. He's our Secretary of Defense. And when it comes to our manufacturing base, they look to Connecticut. They look to Electric Boat. They look to Sikorsky. They look to Pratt. And Electric Boat has had, you know, a half dozen infections there on their plant floor, as well as the CEO. So we work closely with defense as well as others in the federal government. We tell Secretary Esper, look, when it comes to masks, when it comes to testing protocol, other ways, when it comes to fever thermometers, we need your help. You want us to prioritize these workers. We need you to help prioritize these folks so they can keep defending America on the front lines, but do it safely. You know, with that, let me introduce to you a...
On the top of the list in terms of receiving Abbott Lab testing devices here in Connecticut. So we should see that arrive at DPH and then for distribution later this week.
And then where do we stand on the PPE and the hospital space right now? We know that, you know, this is going to be a very trying week. How are we in maintaining
of our hospitals? They've been able to get enough to keep going for the near term. We have a very good accounting of where the PPE is, where the ventilators are, where they're needed. So our hospital system is working as one, as I suggested before, so we have to buy more time. We may be able to mix and match. And I will tell you that we're on the phone with the senior executives from the company that has the sterilization process and equipment for the PPE. It's been certified by the FDA. They're just beginning to release that now. And I have it on very good authority that Connecticut's going to be at the very top of that list for getting that equipment.